This is episode 97 of Social Entrepreneur with Nakul Sarin of Rare.
Really spending the time to build the trust with these communities, to understand their needs and to sort of really prioritize them. And so when you think about it, you know, at McKinsey, the question would be, who's your client, right? And so being really clear about who's your client here and how are you really trying to help them on what they feel is most important.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 97 of Social Entrepreneur with Nakul Sarin of Rare. Now, before we go into today's episode, I just wanted to remind you that this Wednesday, July the 20th, we're holding a free webinar, and this is How to Make a Difference While Making a Living, with a hint of no ramen noodles are required. And we're going to talk about how to overcome the five most common roadblocks to being a changemaker, the seven key characteristics of successful changemakers, if I could say that, the 10 steps on the path to changemaking, and the four criteria used by impact investors when they look at social enterprises. So it's going to be a really jam-packed webinar with lots of value. I really would encourage you to be there. If you're at all thinking about being a changemaker, this is the place to be this Wednesday. Okay, so to the episode. Now, Nakul Sarin is with a company called Rare, an organization called Rare, and they work with nearshore fishers. Well, Rare does a lot of things. They're really in the behavior change business. Part of that is a thing called Fish Forever. And Nakul and his team, they work with nearshore fishers who are basically the smallholder farmers of the sea. And the problem is that we catch between 80 and 90 metric tons of ocean life every year. And two-thirds of nearshore fisheries are either fully depleted or they're in severe decline. Now, Nakul and his team, they work with local change makers to help change behavior. And he's going to tell you how they do that and how they have multi-party agreements between the government and the local people and NGOs, and it's a really fascinating story. And what I really love about Nakul's story is how he brings the thinking of a McKinsey consultant to this really big problem. So here he is, Nakul Sarin of Rare.
Hi, my name is Nakul Sarin, and I work for an organization, a global conservation organization called Rare. And I lead a program there called Fish Forever, which is focused on building a global movement towards empowering local fishers to help them in recovering the oceans and in restoring the global fisheries on which they depend, not just for food, but also for their livelihoods.
So can you sort of fly over the problem for us a little bit?
Sure, I'm happy to. So at a high level, if you look at our global fisheries, it's an incredibly important source of protein for many parts of the world, and in particular to coastal communities. And in places like Indonesia and the Philippines, it can make up as much as 40 to 50% of their primary source of animal protein. But if you look at the state of fisheries, with the exception of perhaps North America, Europe, and maybe Australia and New Zealand, most of the fisheries are in decline, and that decline, while reversible, is unfortunately accelerating as the pressures on these fisheries continue to increase manifold. You're seeing increased population pressure and increased demand for seafood, but then it's also being mixed with challenges related to climate change, like acidification and warming, which are leading to a decline in the natural habitat of these fisheries as well. So you're dealing with the states of what could lead to pretty tragic consequences if we're not able to do something fairly soon.
I saw somewhere, I think it was in some of Rare's materials, that two-thirds of nearshore fisheries are either fully depleted or they're in severe decline.
Yes, that's correct. And that's a scary situation, and especially when you're dealing with an environment where, you know, the demand for fish continues to increase. And so a big part of the problem here has been, so the good news actually we should say is that there is a story of hope here, that you can actually recover these fisheries. And if you recover these fisheries, you'd actually be able to get more fish under a more sustainable management plan. And so that's what we're really trying to emphasize. The problem is, in order to be able to get that, there are several barriers that we need to tackle. The first is that fisheries in many countries is sort of the classic tragedy of the commons. It's hard for any one actor alone to go out, step forward and say, okay, you know what, I'm going to take the lead in this. You actually need a high degree of coordination and collaboration across not just one country and within one country, but across many countries. And so it's trying to overcome that challenge that is really the ultimate focus of Fish Forever.
Yeah. So how do you do that? What's your approach? What's your solution? What's your approach?
Yeah. So our fundamental solution is what we call a TURF reserve. And TURF stands for Territorial User Rights for Fishing. So it's sort of a play on the name, but it's really about giving ownership to fishermen over the fisheries or the natural resources on which they depend. We do that by helping them partner with local governments to get the rights or the access privileges over that resource. And in return, what the fishers agree is by acquiring these rights, that they will in turn help to manage this fishery to recovery. And one of the key tools for doing that in countries, especially where you don't have, you know, sophisticated technological solutions or strong science bases, you then work on what we call these ideas of no-take zones or reserves. So you cordon off small parts of these exclusive access areas so that you allow the fishery to recover within them. And so think of it as sort of a investment that you make into a bank. That's the capital. And as these fish start to recover, they spawn far more fish. They then move outside of those reserves. And so you're able to actually help the fishery recover by creating these strategically placed no-take zones. And so we work with communities to help them partner with their local governments to get the rights, and then secondly, give them the scientific basis and the training to be able to effectively establish the reserves in the right places so that the fish will actually recover over the long term.
So these TURFs, there's both the use rights, but then there's also a TURF reserve or a no-take zone within that TURF. Is that right?
That's right. So the TURF, yeah. That's why we call it TURF reserve. So it's the TURF, which is the spatial area, and then the reserve is these no-take zones within that they will then protect.
Right. And if the coastal village has been given a TURF right, how do they stop some, you know, foreign trawler from coming through with a dragnet and just clearing it out?
Great question. So I think this is where, you know, especially in communities where we're working, where while there's rule of law, the ability to actually enforce that is often a challenge. And so what we try to do is work on local enforcement models. So whether it might be training them as a community to think about how are they going to actually enforce their waters. So we help them set up small enforcement teams, which are really teams that go out and try to identify vessels that are sort of coming into their waters and being able to report that to the local marine police or to their Coast Guard or Navy. We've also helped them through technological solutions. For example, in the Philippines, we've helped set up and in Indonesia, actually, we've helped set up SMS reporting systems so they can very quickly text infractions and hopefully be able to get a response. And what you see is that the more formal enforcement teams, so the police, the Coast Guards, actually appreciate this because it helps them become more efficient. So rather than going out and endlessly patrolling the seas, they can be much more targeted in the way they think about going after people who are, you know, fishing illegally. But it is a really, really big part of the problem is, you know, as the social cohesion and the social norms that you create only work to the extent that everybody agrees to abide by them. And it doesn't take much in terms of, you know, infractions like the ones you've described to help, you know, undo that. And so a second part of what we really focus on as an organization, and this is really RARE's roots, is RARE is a behavior change and training organization. And our focus has been around, you know, how do you use tactics around social marketing to increase social cohesion and community buy-in so that you can start to see better coordination within these communities to overcome some of these kinds of challenges. So even if you have one person who comes in and fishes in this no-take zone, it doesn't mean it's the end of the program. It just means that the community uses social pressure to potentially punish that individual or other communities who may be responsible for that bad behavior. And so that becomes a really critical part to this program.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, what countries are you currently working in?
So we're in 5 countries at the moment: Indonesia, Philippines, Mozambique, Brazil, and Belize. Each program started at a slightly different time, so it's currently at a different state in terms of the implementation itself. But we kicked off the global initiative on the implementation side in 2014.
Yeah. And since RARE is a behavior change and training organization, what are some of those behaviors locally that have that you've had to overcome? What is, I guess the question in my mind is, what's the culture like when you come in, and what is the culture shift that you are attempting to make there?
So that's a great question. You know, one thing I should say, as a behavior change and training organization, are a big part of our focus is actually to train other people to do the work. So when we partner with communities, we identify local change leaders who are often from the local government agencies responsible for managing this resource. And we train them in becoming basically campaign managers or campaign leaders to help mobilize communities and to help them think through the solution that they want. Because ultimately, it's not about us telling communities what to do. It's about us helping them and equipping them with the tools to make the decisions they think are most appropriate for their communities. And so what you find in many communities is that there is a clear recognition that the fisheries are in decline. They see the habitat loss. They see the fact that their catches are decreasing year on year. They see that the catches are getting smaller, so you're getting smaller, much smaller fish than they used to. And you know, it's a recognition that that's a problem. The challenge is what they're not necessarily always as well equipped with is how do they bring the community together to and empower themselves to be able to manage the resource. And that's really where we come in to help them. I think a second piece is helping is sort of reestablish the social contract that exists between governments and communities. In so many of these countries you walk into, there's this almost immediate apprehension of working with governments because often governments are associated with corruption or, just bureaucracy. But in fact, because we're in the business of rights, we're in business of empowering people, it's really about reestablishing that relationship with governments and communities. And so a big part of our intervention is about that. And what you see is as communities start to go through this program and start to partner with local governments, the benefits are not just in the fish space, but you actually start to develop much more resilient communities because you've increased social cohesion. You've started to help address livelihood challenges. And, we know that, you know, the research has shown that one of the most powerful things to help communities adapt with climate change is to help lift them out of poverty. And many of the communities that we deal with that tend to be, you know, the poorest and most vulnerable communities in their countries because fishing is considered to be an employment of last resort, right? If you don't have a plot of land to grow some food, at least you can go out and fish. And so really helping that community sort of change their mindset and see this as that they actually have a way out of thinking about the long-term management of this resource is a very powerful, powerful thing that and transformation that we see on the ground.
I was thinking about what you just said about if you're too poor to have land, so even smallholder farmers are considered better off than people in these poor coastal communities and these near-shore fishers. And at the same time, I mean, they're at the edge of financial stability. And then at the same time, the amount that they could catch in a day is dramatically going down.
Right. Right.
Yes. You know, so that's a tough position to be in.
Some of the research we've looked at, and for example, in a place like the Philippines, there's a term in fishery science that you look at called catch per unit effort. So if the unit of effort is a day of fishing, and so basically the measure is how much would you catch in a day of fishing. And some of the research in places like the Philippines has shown that smallholder fishers, their catch per unit effort in the last 30 years has dropped almost 90%. So whereas one trip used to, you know, they used to bring home 40 kilos of fish, they now only bring home 4. And so you can just see the state that they're in. And so whereas in the past they would, with 40 kilos of fish, they would keep some so that they'd be able to feed their families, and fish is an incredibly nutritious source of food, they're now selling whatever they can get and using the money to buy much less nutritious food to feed their families. So the implications are well beyond just, are we, you know, protecting this, you know, important and incredibly beautiful natural resource, but it's really about people's livelihoods. It's about food security and sort of the consequences of not managing these important ecosystems effectively.
So, what was your path? How did you end up doing this work?
So, it's a somewhat long story, but I'll try to keep it short. My father was a diplomat, and we moved around most of my life. On my 10th birthday, we moved to Mauritius, which is this beautiful island in the Indian Ocean. And I fell in love with the oceans. And I remember our first day of landing there was going to the beach. And we spent about 4 years there, and I became very attached to spending time on the oceans. And it was much more in a recreational sense. But then we moved after that, and I started to miss the ocean and thinking about, okay, it's getting to a point where I was about to graduate from high school and sort of thinking about, okay, what could I do next? I enjoyed math and science and engineering. And then I was going through, you know, literally flipping through a book of, you know, different degrees that you could take. And I heard about this degree called ocean engineering. And I was like, wow, this sounds really, really cool. I get to spend my time by the ocean and work on a whole variety of very interdisciplinary topics, just that they're in the application, in an ocean application. And so I went and got a degree, an undergraduate degree, and then a master's degree in ocean engineering. And while I was there, I had a couple of great professors and started to learn about the world of coral reefs and sort of the natural ecosystem, and sort of looking at how could you use engineering tools or technology to help manage coastal ecosystems more effectively. And then, you know, there was this question of, okay, what do you do next once I graduate? And, you know, do I go work for the NGO or do I go work for the World Bank? And I came across an article in Harvard Business Review that was written by a director at McKinsey. And they talked about McKinsey, you know, establishing a climate change special initiative. And I said, wow, that's a really fascinating way to think about this problem of, you know, the role of business and the private sector in this space. And so I applied and I joined McKinsey and spent almost 7-8 years there. And I split my time between our economic development practice and our sustainability practices. So it was really looking at the intersection of natural resource use for economic development purposes, and how do you do that in a sustainable way so that it benefits not just the private sector, but obviously the social sector and the communities and the populations who are dependent on it. And that was really an incredible journey. And so I got to spend a lot of time working with governments, with large international organizations and multilateral organizations. My last few years actually allowed me to spend a few, you know, my incredible mentors there allowed me to spend a little bit of time thinking about how could you bring McKinsey's expertise and its sort of approach to the topic of oceans and fisheries. And I had an incredible 3 years of sort of starting to work in that space, whether it's working with private equity companies making investments in the fishery sector or ministries of fisheries thinking about how they more effectively manage their fishing resources. And so I loved that experience. And then started to think about, you know, but what was missing for me was really connecting it to communities. And what I found was a big problem in the fishing industry is that 50% of the catch, the global catch of fish, comes from these large industrial commercial boats. But the remaining 50% comes from small-scale fishers, where the issue is more than just about profitability and revenues, but it's really about livelihoods. And I noticed that I was spending all my time focused on the industrial side and not on the small scale side. And I really wanted to spend more time understanding the problem from that side of the dimension of the coin, and say, you know, what could we do to work in that space? It sort of felt like the elephant in the room. 90% of fishers are small scale fishers. 90% of boats are small scale boats. So it was funny for me to see that, you know, we're spending all this time on, you know, these high value exportable species, but nobody's spending time on the really vulnerable communities. So that led me to start looking around and saying, okay, so who is doing work in that space? And that's where Rare had just started to announce a program on Fish Forever and said, you know, we've got this ambition of bringing behavior change to small-scale fisheries, and we're looking for somebody to help us think about what does it actually mean to execute a program like this. And that's where I came in to join and lead that effort.
Yeah, and that was about August of 2014, is that right?
That's correct. So just about hitting my two-year mark.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Fish Forever, it's not just Rare. There's a couple of partner organizations in there too, aren't there?
That's correct. So Fish Forever is conceived by three partners. So it's Rare, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the University of California at Santa Barbara. And within the University of UCSB, there's a group called the Sustainable Fisheries Group. And so the three organizations really spent, you know, the first year and a half sort of figuring out how to design this program, right? What is it actually going to look like? And helping Rare, which had done work in fisheries but wasn't a fisheries organization, helping to build the technical capabilities of the organization. And we've now sort of transitioned to this implementation phase. And what I like to say is actually the partnership extends well beyond just these three organizations, because if you look at any one of the countries we work in, there are numerous partners from national governments to local governments to other NGOs, and now even private sector, who are partnering with us to help implement this. Because for us, we're not satisfied with just working in a handful of sites in any one country. Our real goal is, you know, how do we think about a model that scales nationally? And we know that we can't do that alone. We need an entire ecosystem of partners to do that. So the three were the founding partners, is the one way to put it. And we're now sort of expanding into a whole set of implementing partners.
Very good. So how is Fish Forever funded then?
So we have a mix of funders. I'd say the majority of the initial funding came from philanthropic sources, so large foundations, and from individuals who are interested in supporting Rare and Fish Forever. And then over time, we've now started to also get more funding from multilateral and bilateral agencies who are helping us just think through the scale piece of this program. And national governments and local governments themselves are now starting to allocate small and slightly growing budgets towards this program as well, whether it's through direct financial contributions or in kind. For example, like the campaign managers I mentioned in each of these countries, they're basically seconded to Rare to work with us for 2 to 3 years. And, you know, that's a contribution the local governments make to the program.
As you think about what you've learned over the last couple of years starting up Fish Forever, now, you came from this McKinsey background. I know you spent just a little bit of time with EY before that,
yeah,
even, and other organizations. So, but I have a lot of respect for McKinsey and for their experts and consultants. And so I really appreciate your background and your thinking that you're bringing to this. So what's something maybe that has surprised you, or a lesson that you've learned that you'd like to pass along to somebody else considering this kind of journey?
You know, I think what was there are a couple of things. I think, you know, I had great mentors at McKinsey, and I think a very powerful skill that I learned there was this idea of how do you structure a problem in sort of a really clear way, because unless you can articulate the problem clearly, you're not really going to come up with an effective solution. And that's so much of what you're trained in at McKinsey is around that, and the sort of the problem-solving approach at McKinsey. And so that's been incredibly helpful for me, because, you know, one of the great challenges of working on a program like the one we're working on is that it's incredibly complex, right? A McKinsey mentor of mine, this guy named Jeremy Oppenheim, liked to say, you know, sometimes complex problems require complex solutions, right? And that's so true in what we're doing, right? It's like we were talking about, it's not just about the allocation of rights, but it's also about thinking through food security. It's about thinking about the links of markets. It's about enforcement. It's about long-term financial sustainability of these programs. So you're bringing so many disparate sectors together to try and solve this problem. That's a skill set that I think I've learned through McKinsey, and because I've had the opportunity to work in so many different sectors, I'm able to communicate with so many folks in different sectors that allows us to bring, you know, do a little bit of the coalition building that's necessary to implement these solutions. And so this idea of, you know, not limiting yourself to just working in the private sector or just working in the government or just working in NGOs, but the fact that you can build coalitions around problems, I think that's really where you start to see transformational impact. And that's my advice would be to spend time thinking about that.
Yeah, building coalitions to solve these problems. I think the other thing that you said is sometimes complex problems require a complex answer. There's some kind of quote, and I'll get it wrong, but it's something like, for every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong.
So true.
And I think too often we go there, don't we? We go, well, you know, it's a simple solution. All you have to do is, X. you know, stop the Chinese trawler that comes through once a month and you've solved the problem.
Right.
Or, you know, whatever that thing is, that's the obvious answer. But sometimes the obvious answer, especially when you are able to structure the problem, when you are able to really articulate the problem in a clear and distinct way, then you understand that these problems are multi-pronged and complex, and they really take a multi-pronged and complex solution, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think that's a one thing I have to say that I've really come to appreciate through my work at Rare and working with the campaign managers and our teams in each of these countries is, you know, really spending the time to build the trust with these communities, to understand their needs and to sort of really prioritize them. And so when you think about it, you know, at McKinsey, the question would be, who's your client, right? And so being really clear about who's your client here and how are you really trying to help them on what they feel is most important. And that's hard to do in you know, when you're dealing with large communities who have a variety of different needs and priorities and but it's really important that you take the time to invest in building a community around a problem and then the answer.
Very good. Well, listen, if people were looking for Fish Forever online or on social media, where would they look?
So they could look at our website, rare.org. So it's rare.org. We also have some information at fishforever.org, but we're going to be migrating that site over to Rare's. So that would be the first place to go, and then I'm fairly easy to find and people can reach out to me, and I'm always happy to chat about the work we do. It's my favorite topic. So
okay, well, what's your favorite social media that you connect with people through? Is it Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or how do you like to connect?
LinkedIn and Twitter are the two where I seem to spend most of my time.
What's one thing you would love for people to go and do as a result of this conversation?
So what I'd love people to be able to do coming away from this conversation is first understanding you know, the importance of fisheries to communities and recognizing that the choices they make in terms of the kind of seafood they buy and the practices they have in terms of the kind of impact that it has, not just on fish, but all of these communities that are dependent on it. And being able to think about, you know, fisheries beyond just as being a conservation challenge, but thinking about it across all of these different silos. I think that's really important. If we can start to get people to see that it's as much a food security issue and a climate change issue as it is a conservation issue, I think we'll have we'll be able to mobilize an even bigger movement towards restoring this important resource.
Very good. Well, Nakul, thank you so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday. Be sure to join us next Monday when we'll be joined by Gianluca Sescan of Devergy. If you'd like the show notes for today, you could head over to tonyloyd.com/097. That's tonyloyd.com/097. Now, while you're there, you're going to find a link to that webinar that's coming up this week. And the webinar is called How to Make a Difference While Making a Living. So thanks again for joining us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.